Hey, Casey Scott here from Project Recovery Podcast. When I took my first steps towards confronting my addiction, I needed a program that could help guide me through my recovery. That's why I wanted to tell you about Reprieve Recovery. They are a recovery center for women that recognize the importance of healing the spirit, mind, body, and are located in beautiful Mountain Green, Utah. You can learn more by calling 801-252-6030 or visiting their website at reprieverc.com. Welcome to Project Recovery, a podcast about addiction. More importantly, it's about recovery. I'm Casey Scott. That's Dr. Matt Woolley. He's a clinical psychologist and one of my best friends.
Thanks, buddy.
And you brought something here and you're feverishly working on it. But before we get to that.
Feverishly, yes.
I like to kind of, keep people updated on my recovery and what my life looks like.
That is why we're here.
And so I had something interesting happen.
Oh, good.
Me and the lovely Leslie, the girlfriend. It was,
She's your partner at this point.
Yeah, right? She is.
You guys live together.
We live together.
Don't you feel silly saying girlfriend? Because I do. I'm 52 and I technically have a girlfriend, but I feel a little self-conscious.
I feel silly saying my
girlfriend.
I feel silly saying partner.
Yeah, it is.
We're not a law firm. You know what I mean? We're not joint realtors. You know what I mean?
It's so
I just say my girlfriend.
Just say lovely Leslie. That's
the lovely
good.
Leslie.
I shouldn't have interrupted. Keep going.
So we were out to dinner.
Yeah.
With a group of people.
Where?
Just in Ogden. And they said, hey, there's this new bar that opened in town. Would you guys like to go? And I looked at Leslie. She looked at me. And I was like, sure. So let's go down there. Because I've said it before, I still like hanging around the debauchery. I still like the people. And I'm usually good.
I just like it when you use the word debauchery.
I love it. Yeah. And I'm usually good till about 11 o'clock. Yeah. And that's when people start getting drunk and talking to your shoulder. And that's when I tap out. I do what we say is the Irish exit. And an Irish exit is where all of a sudden you just leave. Because if you say you're going to leave, then someone's going to talk to you.
And so you're the one that taught me that years ago, and I use it a lot.
Yeah. And you also got it from Seinfeld, where you make a big deal about saying hi so that they know you were there. So when you leave, you were like, no, they were
there.
Here. I saw them. Yeah, it was cool. So we go to this bar, and we're hanging out. And everybody's having a good time, and it's packed, and I'm seeing people that I haven't seen for years, in my home city, and it's a good time. But it gets to that point where I was like, oh, I'm tired. Let's go home. And she's like, okay. And so we say goodbye to everybody, and we walk out. And we're walking out with this other group, and they go, huh, when did you get in a wreck in your car? My girlfriend instantaneously freaks out. I didn't. And he goes, looks like somebody hit you.
Oh.
Somebody had hit her car in the parking lot and left.
Yeah, that is the worst.
Hit by what we assume would be a drunk driver.
Probably.
And if you knew my girlfriend.
I do.
She's very OCD about her stuff. So much in fact that her first thought was, I got to sell the car now. I go, why? She goes, it'll never be the same.
All or nothing.
It'll never be the same. And I was like, well, let's take a look at it and not. And so we go out there and the back end was just
got you pretty good.
Smashed in. So instantaneously we become Scooby-Doo. We're going to solve this mystery.
So, of course.
So we go into the bar. We go, hey, do you have cameras outside? She goes, why? Yes, we do. Do you mind if we take a look at them? Not at all. They pull up the cameras. We're looking at it. Sure enough, there's a guy that walks out of the bar, gets in his car, 3-point turn into the car. Didn't even get the car coming out.
Wow.
3-point turned into the car, pulled away, and left.
Oh, wow.
So then I look at this picture. I go into the bar. I go to the waitresses. I go, hey, does anybody know this guy? And they're like, yeah, he was sitting right on over there. So I go over to that section and I talk to the waitress there and I go, do you remember this? And she was like, no, I don't remember him, but I think he paid by credit card. I can probably pull that up. I go, why don't you do that?
Nice.
So they pull him up and I get his name. Then you know where I go?
I don't know.
Facebook.
The Facebook.
I instantly go to the Facebook.
Casey's all to go to everything.
Yep, so I go to the Facebook, type in his name, pops up a picture. I show it to the waitress. I go, is this the guy? And she goes, yes, it is. So then I'm walking out. I'm asking anybody, hey, does anybody know this guy by chance? And this one guy goes, yeah, I do. I go, you don't happen to have his phone number, do you? Sure do.
Great.
Do you mind if I get it? Yeah, just don't tell him I gave it to you. Not a problem. So he gives me the number.
Yeah.
So I go outside. I get on the phone. He answers. He goes, hey. And I go, hey. He goes, who's this? I go, this is the guy's car you just hit. What are you talking about? I go, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And if you want to keep going, I can show you video because I've got it on my phone.
Wow.
There's some few choice words that go back and forth, and it gets a little chaotic.
You are from Ogden and in Ogden. Yeah. So yeah.
And I said, hey, look, man, first and foremost, did you make it home all right? Yeah.
Well, that's thoughtful of you.
That's good.
Yeah.
So we got two choices here. Either you're going to make this right, or the officers are going to come to your house. I said, I'm not here to jam you up, man. And,
but that's what insurance is for.
That's what insurance is for.
Sure.
So what are we going to do here? And he's not happy. I'm not happy. More choice words are thrown back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes to the end, and I go, hey, look, man, you're talking to a guy who's in recovery 5 years. And I know from experience what this can do to you physically, emotionally, and financially. I need you to promise me that you're going to stay home. Yeah. And I need you to promise me that you're going to make this right. Because I'm not happy. And I know from firsthand experience what a disaster this can be.
Mm-hmm. You sure do.
So, sounds like you've had a few. Let's continue this conversation tomorrow. And let's see where this is going to go. I got a text at 6 a.m.
Mm.
I'm so sorry. I am so embarrassed and so grateful that the cops didn't show up at my house last night, because that would have ruined my world. And I go, I get it, man. I do. I'm not here to jam you up,
mm-hmm.
but I know how selfish and how dangerous drinking and driving can be.
Yeah.
And at this point, we're not even talking about the car. I'm talking about people's lives.
Well, you know firsthand about that, right?
And I said, so what are we going to do? Because I don't have insurance.
Oh.
That's a problem. Let me see what I can do. Now, this is the lady's car, you know. Mm. And I talked to her, and she was cool. And I said, let's, you know, I'm just telling you, from one guy who's in recovery to another guy who's probably should be close.
Maybe.
Let's work with him, and let's see how it goes.
Yeah.
And she goes, okay. She goes, I'm going to trust you on this. Mm. I said, thank you. So we set up a payment plan, and he's fulfilled his first payment, and he's going to do it. And I talked to him last night, and I said, hey, look, man, I want you to know that this sucks. This isn't fun for anybody. And he goes, after the accident, I haven't had a drink since.
Oh.
And my life is starting to get better.
That's great.
And he goes, had the cops shown up, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be in jail.
Yep.
And I said, well, I hope this is, you know, a turning point for you. I said, but let me be a resource for you if you ever want to call or you ever want to talk. He goes, I appreciate that. He goes, I feel kind of weird because I owe you all this money. And I go, I get that. Mm-hmm. But that's apples and oranges. You know what I mean? Is it somebody who's been where you are? I want to be there for you. He goes, well, I'm working on it. He goes, maybe one day we can get together and barbecue and talk about this. And I go, okay. I go, but just save my number, and if you ever need to talk.
That's what I love about you, Casey. You took it from a fight to a connection.
Because at one point,
that's a classic Casey move.
At one point, yeah. I was supposed to meet him on his front lawn and throw dukes.
You know what I mean? You're getting too old for that, yeah. Man.
And I was like, bro, I'm 49, man. I'm not going to show up on your front porch.
Right.
You know, I was like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that to anybody. Right. And I feel guilty because, I mean, I know he broke the law. You know what I mean? But I do know from firsthand experience what kind of disaster that could throw me in.
Yeah. That's...
You know, and so I was like, hey, look, man, I'm giving you a way out. If you do not come to an agreement with me or figure out a way out, then I'll be forced to call.
Yeah.
And I don't want to, man, because I know the pain you're in, bro. I know it. I've been there. I can see it. I've been you.
Yeah.
So let's figure out a way to get out of this, you know?
what you did in therapy terms is called evocative empathy. And what that means is that when we show empathy towards somebody, it can evoke a positive response and change in the other person. And it started off intense, but you got around to empathizing with him and letting him know, you know, how he's feeling. You're taking his point of view and showing him empathy and sleeping it off a little.
Yeah.
That combo helped him wake up early in the morning and feel some remorse and take responsibility. And that's a beautiful thing. I don't know that we'd need all the laws we have if people were empathetic and took responsibility for themselves and for others. And yeah, that's,
you know,
great.
We've talked about it before on the podcast, and some of the laws are archaic, you know what I mean?
Sure.
And they're just punitive, you know what I mean?
Right.
And it's an eye for an eye. And I'm not arguing that sometimes that doesn't need to be done,
sure,
but there's a whole prison and a whole jail system that is full of people who are in there for the wrong reasons and not getting the right things looked at.
Absolutely.
I mean, and I talk about this all the time because we had that one guy on, and he, and I forget his name, but he was in jail for 9 months mm-hmm. for car theft.
Right.
And he goes, "I'm not a car thief. I'm a heroin addict."
Right.
"But I had to steal the car so I could afford heroin."
Right.
You know, and he goes, "But I get into jail and I'm automatically thrown in with all the car thieves, but I'm a heroin addict."
Right.
"Nobody's talking to me about
my
addiction."
We're addressing the wrong thing.
Addressing the wrong problem.
Yep.
You know, and so I think you're right. And so I don't know if I did the right thing. It felt right. And
it feels right to me. I mean, that's, I don't think it could turn out better for either one of you, because there were no fist fights on the front lawn. Nobody went to jail and got thrown in with the wrong crowd and didn't get the help that they really needed. And now he has an opportunity to develop some insight and maybe change his life.
And he's been very forthright. He texts, you know what I mean? Because I remember my girlfriend's like, if you're going to have to chase this guy down for money, that's going to be your job. And I go, okay, I will take that. I will take that.
Yeah.
You know, and if I got to make the phone calls and I got to get the texts and I got to get into it, I will do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, let's just try this. And she was cool with it.
Good for you guys. Good for Leslie for letting you do it.
So far, the first payment's there and everything's right good.
Cool.
So I'll keep you updated on how it goes.
Actually, let's make sure that we do.
Yeah.
Because I want to hear the outcome.
Who knows? Maybe he'll come on the podcast.
That would be amazing.
Right?
I would love it.
We'll see
what
happens.
I would love that. Yeah.
So you've got some stuff that you brought.
Well, that's a perfect segue to a very short little story that I have.
Okay.
Now, I don't know if people remember this, but back in May of this year, the Surgeon General put out a statement that said loneliness, isolation, and lack of connection in the United States is a public health crisis. Do you remember that?
Yep.
And that was something that we've been talking about for years, that COVID was the first and that mental health was going to be the second. And I think everyone is in agreement with that. And an interesting, there's a doctor named Robert Waldinger from Harvard, and he is in charge and works with a study that's been going on since 1938.
Really?
Yeah. And that has tracked 724 original participants and over 1,300 of their descendants. And what they are looking at is health, mental and physical health over a lifespan, and the connection with community and close relationships and what that affects. So some people without a community and without close relationships are in the study, and people with those things are in the study. And do you want to, any guesses about the outcome of the study?
Well, I think those who have a community live a fuller, richer, more mentally stable life.
Absolutely. In the study, the people were most satisfied with their relationships at age 50 were also the healthiest at age 80.
Really?
So people who by their 50s could say that they had a good community and healthy connections with other people, they felt loved and they had healthy interactions, were not just the most satisfied, but by the age of 80, where a lot of people aren't around still or they're really in failing health, they were the healthiest of the groups that were in the study. And these people's mental health was even sharper. They had less dementia, and they also had a higher reported quality of life. And he said that some people have misunderstood that this is about showing love. And he said it is about showing love, but he prefers the word that we use, connection. He said connection is a feeling, but it's also an activity.
Yep.
And so I just came across that. There was a lot of different articles I could have brought in today, but I was like, holy cow, that is at the center of this show.
Well, that's what we say all the time here on the podcast. The opposite of addiction isn't abstinence.
Right.
The opposite of addiction is
connection.
connection. And it's finding that connection that helps you strive, that helps you live, that helps you just get through. And I'm excited because that's a perfect segue into our guest today. His name is John Curran. How are you doing, buddy?
I'm doing good.
And we were talking off air, and we were talking about our DOCs. Mm-hmm. And at one point, you were saying you were driving truck.
Yeah, driving. I was an over-the-road truck driver.
Yep.
And it wasn't like meth or heroin that I would be shooting. You know, the drug of choice at that time would be alcohol. I mean, because it's socially acceptable. It's everywhere. I could walk into a truck stop after my shift. My truck's parked out in the back. I'm getting ready to get in the shower, grab a couple tall boys, and I'm good to go.
Is this your twin?
Yeah, he's got a shower beer.
You know, no, and
shower beer's right.
Yeah, yeah, it's where it's at. You know, and it was a daily thing.
But you said something that was kind of led me to the connection part. Is that it was a way for you to get away from yourself?
Yeah, well, because no matter where I go, I'm there. You know, I when I get up in the morning and I look in the mirror, I'm getting ready to brush my teeth. Guess who I got to look at? I've got to look at me. You know what I mean? I might get to pet my dog in the morning or whatnot, but I've still got to deal with my daily life every day. Mm-hmm. I got to deal with the actions that I distribute upon people every day.
Now, do you feel like the Bud Light or the beer gave you an escape from yourself?
I mean, in my thinking process at that time, yeah. I mean, not only did it give me an escape from the stress of every minute of my day counting and my boss breathing down my neck or having to be somewhere or the snowstorm outside or the traffic that I'm dealing with. Yeah. I mean, it gave me an exit from like my negative thinking of wanting to freak out and jump out of the truck and start wailing on somebody for no reason. Cause they cut me off, you know, or the fact that, you know, my thinking was so messed up at the time that I needed some sort of an escape or some sort of an excuse not to be in my head.
Well, I love it. And you're going to love John's story because we're going to talk about John as a young man, John being in race riots, and John being in gang fights and even some prison time. John's story is coming up next. You're listening to Project Recovery. Hey, Casey Scott here, and I'm happy to say our podcast, Project Recovery, is sponsored by Reprieve Recovery. Reprieve is a women's only center located in Mountain Green, Utah. Find out more on their website at ReprieveRC.com. Hey, welcome back to Project Recovery. I'm Casey Scott. That's Dr. Matt Woolley. Our guest today is John Curran. And John said off air, he goes, I got a pretty crazy story, Casey. Do you want me to tell the whole story? And what did I tell you, John?
He said, yeah, your story's your story. And hopefully we can connect with somebody that can help.
You know, and because I feel like sometimes when we whitewash a story, even for our KSL audience, we're really doing a disservice. Because I remember for the longest time, there was things that I carried around in my battle with addiction that I held that I thought this makes me a horrible person that I can't believe. And I bet nobody else has done this. I bet, you know, and all this stuff. And it wasn't until I sat down in a process setting and said some of the things out loud for the very first time that somebody went, oh, that's it?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Okay. You know what I mean?
Well, the problem with not being fully honest and authentic with others is that we have misconceptions like, oh, you know, I can't tell anybody else's because they would never understand this. I remember 20 years ago, the first time I had done some of this stuff on the radio on that morning show that we both know.
Yeah.
And people called in and said, wait a second, really? You like, that's a common thing? And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's common. They're like, I had one of our very first callers on the air say, I thought I was the only one that ever did that.
Yep.
Isn't that sad that we hold on to that stuff when we say it out loud, other people go, oh yeah, is that it?
I do that all the time.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
It totally changes our relationship with those sorts of issues.
Because after time carrying that around, it gets heavy.
Oh yeah.
It starts to drag you down and it eventually will bury you if you let it.
Mm-hmm. It will.
So let's get to John. Where does the story of John begin?
So I have an addiction. Well, I'm in recovery for an addiction to meth is a big one. And it starts with a diagnosis of ADDH at the age of 7, which later turned into ADHD. At first, that's what it was called, was ADDH.
They used to distinguish between the inattentive type as a separate diagnosis from the hyperactive type. So
yeah, I think right. I was a little bit of both. But so
yeah, now we just say ADHD and then we decide what of the four types it could be.
So at that point, when it first started, they started me on amphetamine, and the doses just started going up and up and up.
So that was the answer to ADHD back then, was to put you on a little amphetamine?
Yeah. I mean,
was that Ritalin?
Ritalin is methylphenidate.
Okay.
And it's still a medicine that's used. And when it's used properly for the right diagnosis, it's pretty helpful. But it was also way overdiagnosed because people were misdiagnosed.
And so at that time, and then they tried to diagnose me with a rapid mood swing bipolar disorder, which is off, way off. I mean, a lot of it, I think, stems back to the ADHD. Mm-hmm. And eventually it turned into a meth addiction at about 13 years old.
Meth at 13?
Yeah.
Is that the first substance you used?
The first? No, the first substance would be marijuana. Cigarettes, marijuana, alcohol.
So when was the first, like, nine. How old were you?
Nine.
What did you start with?
Marijuana.
So even before a cigarette?
For cigarettes was eight.
Okay.
Because I stole those from my mom, you know, and stole the beer from my dad. Mm-hmm. And me and my best friend growing up, that's what we did. And then we started smoking cigarettes regularly, and I just barely quit. Just so you know.
Good for you.
And nicotine free.
So at 9 years old, 8 years old, stealing cigarettes.
Yeah.
Because I've got a 12-year-old, and I thought me starting drinking at the age of 14 was really young, which it is.
It is.
It is.
But I'm glad you brought that up, John, because when I talk with parents, they often are in denial that their elementary school kids might be tempted to start with that, because unfortunately, I've known personally many over the years where at the tender age of, you know, 7, 8, 9, they're starting with substance abuse.
And so do you remember, was there a euphoric feeling, or was when you had your first cigarette, your first beer, what kept you coming back?
So I had a brother that was 6.5 years older than I am.
Uh-huh.
And he smoked. And so I thought it was cool. I thought it was the cool thing to do because, you know,
yeah,
my dad drank beer, mm-hmm. you know, at night when he'd come home, and my brother was involved in that. And that's kind of where my downhill went down, you know, and that's what drew me down. And then as my behavior started to change and I was the way that I acted, I mean, I went from school to school to school because I wasn't able to be taught the same way that kids were taught. And they didn't understand it back then. They had no clue what it was. You know, they just kind of transferred me to a different school or a different smaller class time, and they wouldn't understand when I would get pissed because I would ask a teacher a question and the teacher would look at me like just dumbfounded, like, you know, how could you ask that question when I just didn't comprehend what she would say? You know, I remember she would be speaking perfect English, and that to me it was like she was speaking a foreign language. I couldn't
Klingon.
I couldn't comprehend it. And then when I'd get pissed off and I'd start yelling at her or whatever because she was making me feel like I was an idiot in front of all my classmates. You know, it was frustrating, you know, and then trying to explain that to my mom and dad and my grandpa and my grandma, you know, I felt like an idiot, you know?
What John's describing here, unfortunately, I think happens to a lot of kids back then. I mean, it makes me think of Rob Eastman. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He knew at a young age that he had it wasn't a learning disability, but it was, I guess it was.
Well, yeah. I mean, ADHD and what we call specific learning disabilities, whether it's something with reading, writing, or comprehension, or math, are still problematic, of course. They're neurodevelopmental. It's no one's fault that children have those things. And fortunately, we've come a long way in the last 20 years in helping people in the schools recognize and get better treatments, but it's still a problem.
So it sounds like you had a pretty rough early childhood when it came to school and friends and education.
I mean, I hated school. And what's funny is I have a daughter that's 15. She'll be 16 in February. And she doesn't like school either. But she doesn't like the large class sizes. But she's so much smarter than I am. And she reacts so much different because I would get pissed off. But she just doesn't go. She just won't go, you know. And we're working on that. We've got her transferred into a different school as soon as she turns 16 and things like that. But I remember just feeling ostracized and then not fitting in and then having problems with the kids in school because of the way I acted in class or because I'd be so frustrated in class that when they'd say something to me or they would joke with me, I would take it the wrong way. And then I'd have a problem with them. And I wasn't afraid to be violent. You know what I mean? I wasn't afraid to do that. And it just progressed for so long. it turned into a criminality eventually.
You know, and I think that happens a lot with kids, you know, where they lean into it. You know, rather than address it, they're like, well, I'm going to be the bad boy, so let's see how far this can go. And so it sounds like you chose that road, or it was chosen for you, and just went with it.
Yeah, I did. And it did.
The problem is, though, that's the time in life when we're learning for the first time who we think we are.
Mm-hmm.
And so, not to get too far down that road, but when you're an infant, you don't have an internal voice. Your external voice from your parent starts to, it's how you start to think about yourself. And then you develop your internal voice, but you end up in school where, how do the teachers talk to me and about me? How do the other students talk to me and about me? And you start to believe certain things about yourself. One of the biggest tragedies of ADHD is that it actually doesn't have anything to do with your IQ. ADHD is a cognitive developmental issue on how well you form focus and attention. But a lot of kids, of course, if you don't have attention, you don't understand. If you don't understand, you get poor grades. And unfortunately, we think grades means intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of kids can leave first grade already convinced that they're dumb. And that is such a sad, unfortunately, sometimes lifelong self-identity that I'm not a smart person, I'm not a good learner, or I'm the bad kid, or I'm the problem kid. And so we have to be really careful as educators, as parents, as even older siblings. What we tell kids who are 4, 5, 6, 7 years old starts to become their first belief about themselves. And then we use the term self-fulfilling prophecy. Sometimes we're like, well, if I'm the bad kid, then bad kids don't act good, right? If I act good, I quit being the bad kid. I'm the bad kid, so I'll be bad.
Yeah. So how does that lead to taking up meth at the age 13?
Well, I mean, I started, my parents divorced eventually about, I want to put a time on it. I think I was 12 or so. And I felt outcasted. I mean, I know that once they divorced, I remember one time my dad was at my mom's house, and my mom had already replaced him, it seemed like. And me and my dad didn't always get along, but like I was more for my dad, you know what I mean? And I remember searching for his attention in some way. Thinking back, I don't really ever remember my dad saying he's proud of me. You know what I mean? And that's normal. You know what I mean?
I don't know if it is normal.
It happens a lot, unfortunately, but it does make a negative impact, doesn't it, on how you feel?
Yeah, it does. And, you know, and I just kind of started spiraling. And so we're talking the early 90s. You know what I mean? When Tupac was everywhere,
mm-hmm.
and Notorious B.I.G. And so I started thinking I was a gangster. You know what I mean? And eventually that's what I kind of became, you know, in a sense, you know, and not necessarily that. And as it progressed over the years, I mean, it turned into a racial thing. Once I started going to being incarcerated in the adult system, I mean, that's at that time, that's what it was. It was racial, like if you were white, you got in with the whites. If you were Mexican, that's where you hung out. If you were a gangster, you know, most of the Mexicans hung out there. And then the politics were this or that. I mean, at one point, I think I was 18 or 19 years old, I was in a racially tensioned section between the immigrants that had illegally come over, so the Paisas, as we'd call them, and the whites. And eventually it popped off. Me and another guy got jumped by 15 Paisas because over the payphone, you know?
Wow.
Well, I think one of the worst things about incarcerating people is that often the case is what you're describing. You get put in this, you know, survival situation, and people learn behaviors that are way more violent, aggressive, and negative than you ever came into prison with. And so if you weren't a criminal when you went into prison, you're probably going to be one when you come out. And that's not my opinion. That there's lots of evidence.
It's like Lord of the Flies.
Well, it really, really is. And what you're saying is such a sad thing because, you know, you have to survive, so you find who will protect me. And in order to be part of that group, sometimes you have to do things you would never dream of doing on the outside. So my heart breaks for you at 18 or 19 to be in a situation where all of a sudden you're involved in stuff that you probably wouldn't have ever done, but you were just looking for a place to be safe. And that's a sad, sad commentary on prison.
I want to go back a little bit because you said you started doing meth at the age 13.
Okay.
And how long, was meth your DOC for the majority of your...
Marijuana was for a long time. And I would say, ultimately, like, I just wanted to fit in. You know what I mean? I that's what it came down to. But I had this behavioral problem because I didn't like to go to school. And I wasn't very nice to the teachers, especially a few times after feeling like I was being rejected by the school administration in second grade. You know, and then going to a private school. And I loved going to the private school because I got the attention I needed and she was understanding, you know. Mm-hmm. And then when I came back to public school, it was public school after public school. Every year or two, I was changing schools. Sometimes halfway through the year, you know, in seventh grade, I went to what was a behavioral modification program called Quest. It's Trident Quest. It's through Davis Behavioral Health. And I walked away from that eventually, you know, and I was already smoking weed, but I wasn't going to tell on myself. I had already developed this criminal behavior of you know, I ain't saying nothing, you know, because I ain't getting in trouble for it. So that is another thing in itself. I mean, it took me 10 years to get rid of that, so, to be able to be accountable for my actions.
From age 13 to 18, you know, you ended up being in jail in 18, prison.
I started younger than that.
Really?
Younger than that, yeah.
So for me, looking on the outside in, it seems like you've been in survival mode.
I was in survival mode most of my life. Yeah. And I'm not in survival mode anymore.
That's not a good place to be, Matt.
Well, in lots of different ways, it's not a good place to be. In fact, your body changes. People don't realize that you have high levels of adrenaline, cortisol. It changes your brain chemistry at a time when your brain is still developing. So it actually can make a person feel less trusting, more paranoid on a daily basis if that's what you're having to go through when you're a teenager or a child. Our brains keep developing until we're 24, 25. And what a lot of people don't realize is we always feel like ourselves. But what you don't realize is that brain is who you are. And so if you have a head injury, if you use a lot of drugs, or if you're always in survival mode and your brain is flooded with those survival chemicals, it changes how your brain functions. And so that's a sad place to be for a lot of years, is in survival mode.
So from 13 to 18, running the gun and leaning into kind of the gangster way of life, how did your parents try to deal with you?
They didn't know how. They just kind of accepted it and like tried to get me help. I mean, I started, so at seven, started with FHP. Well, that's where I got my diagnosis. I don't know if you guys remember FHP when FHP was around.
It's a healthcare company.
Yeah, right? It was like IHC now.
Right.
So, started with FHP, started with like psychological stuff, you know, trying to figure out what was going on. And then started with Quest and then Wasatch Canyons, then just like.
And that's so, a residential treatment center. Yeah,
these
for
are
teenagers.
Those are two residential treatment centers. The FHP was more of an outpatient, like, and these are all for behavioral stuff. And I didn't admit to using substance until I think I got in trouble for it. I think I got caught for weed, and ended up getting in a fight with my brother, and I did some things I wasn't happy, but I ended up chasing him with a knife, and I was locked up for about 2 years, but I went into the juvenile system, and I started with detention, then I went to observation and assessment, and then went from observation to assessment to the wilderness program, and then from the wilderness program I went. They wanted to put me into a secured facility, and my dad stepped in and he got me into this place called Lifeline.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in Lifeline for like 8 or 9 months. I was doing really well. I was on juvenile state supervision. And this is it from 15 till 17, I believe, 16, 17, yeah. And I did really well there, you know, and then my dad got this job in California. And he had married my mom's best friend after they had split up. And mm-hmm. I think that did a number on my mom mentally, you know what I mean? But I think that my mom did a number on my dad, leaving him and then replacing him almost immediately. So, I know there had to have been some sort of, but I didn't ever see it. Like, I don't know, like my kid has seen it. It's like, my kids seen it firsthand. Me and my baby's mom didn't get along for the longest time. We finally have learned how to communicate now. But for the longest time, he got that new job, and then they stopped being persistent in my treatment, and they released me from state supervision, so I didn't go back.
So can I just make an observation? And that is that what you're saying, so you have a lot of family chaos, like people in the family are struggling, so the parents aren't able to provide the stability that I'm sure they wish they could have provided for you. And then you are starting with substances in elementary school and relying on those to some degree throughout adolescence. And then you're in these different treatment programs, honestly trying to help you. But all of that, all of those things remove you from the normal, typical developmental course that kids go through. And so the social, the educational, the emotional regulation, the self-esteem and self-concept, the extracurriculars, all those things that are actually really important for kids to be able to experience, to work through and grow up psychologically and emotionally and socially and intellectually were...
stripped.
Yeah, they're gone.
Yeah, I've never been to a school dance. I've never been to...
That was my thought. I was like, when this kid should be figuring out what he wants to be for Halloween or how he's going to answer this girl back for dance, he's getting introduced into a different program.
Trying out for a sports team.
Trying to figure that out.
Doing a school play.
And it
all
breaks my
things.
Heart.
Yeah, it is, because the reason I as people know, I am a developmental psychologist in many ways, and that's one of the things I teach at the university. And physical development is easy to spot. You can tell the difference between a 7-year-old and a 17-year-old, right? But psychological and emotional and cognitive development is just as, if not in many ways, more important than the physical development, but we can't see it on the outside. So people forget that it's there. And we talk to somebody, they're like, what's wrong with that person? Why can't they just calm down? Why can't they just follow the rules? And it's like, well, a guy in your situation is having to make up for all that lost development later in life. And that's probably one of the reasons that you felt out of place, like you said, an outcast. You didn't feel like you fit in.
So as you're running and gunning, where does it go after the race riots when you were age 19? Where do you go from there?
Wait, did I miss race riots?
So I was in a race riot at like 18 or 19.
You got jumped by all the pisces for the phone booth.
Over the phone, because I wouldn't leave my friend hanging. I mean, it was going to be him by himself or me and him and against him. And
so was it a riot in the prison then?
It was in Davis County Jail. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't going to leave him hanging. You know what I mean? I've been left hanging throughout my whole life at this point. Like I had this criminal mentality where I had my people's backs and hopefully they had mine, you know? And most of the time they didn't. And so at 18, my mom lost a house that we had. And so me and my brother were out on our own. And that's when the criminality, I was in and out of jail. I think between the programs and then the incarceration, I think adding it up, I've done about 14 years of incarceration time from the time I was 13. Straight, if I were to do it all straight at one point. And so, it just kind of started a criminal behavioral path. I mean, I was in and out. I was getting caught for possession of drugs or this, and I was going to this program or I was going to that program. And eventually I told the judge, after my daughter was born, I was 23. I had gotten myself in some trouble and me and Tara, which is my baby's mom, couldn't get along. And DCFS ended up involved, and she was going through a program and trying to get my daughter back. And I was still facing charges. I ended up in jail on work release, and DCFS had told me that they were going to take me back and take my daughter's custody of my daughter away from me. And I just spiraled out of control. When they finally caught me, I got an escape charge for leaving the work release facility, and that put me in prison. The first time, I knew I wanted something different. So eventually they put me into the Conquest program. And I don't know if you guys know much about the Conquest program,
but I don't.
It was a minimum of a year. and I made my date leaving prison contingent on the Conquest program, and it took me 16 and a half months to finally graduate the program.
On completion of it.
On completion of that, and I got out that January on the 5th. So I think I did like 2 or 3 years that time. And I got out and was doing really well, you know, but...
you know, that's a saying that you'll hear on this podcast a lot.
Where
they go, I was doing really well. And then they go,
There's a but coming.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
So I think the dysfunction of my family, let me tell you, I got out and I went to a sober, they call them sober living now.
Yeah.
And it was sober living properties then. And
let me ask you this, because that just popped into my head. Sober living, and when you used to get released out of jail 10 years ago, you would go to what kind of house was it? I mean, it was
halfway house.
Halfway house. Are halfway houses sober living?
No.
Oh, okay.
But there's more crime there than you'll ever.
Okay. I just thought maybe halfway houses now transitioned to sober living because of marketing, but.
No, sober living is more like, it had just started at this time. So uh-huh. My dad, I hit my dad up. I was like, hey man, I really want to go into the sober living properties when I get out. Will you help me with the money? So he paid the money and got me in there, you know, and I was doing really well. I was going to go into underwater welding, and I started with nothing. I completed like all my aftercare and all that. Like I was on point to being done with my parole and everything, you know, and I was doing really well. Well, eventually my dad said that I could come up and stay with him. And so I did, and I reacquainted. My daughter's 3 at this time. I reacquainted him with my daughter, and she's coming over to the sober living all the time. She's staying there. She's not even supposed to be staying there. She pretty much runs the house. Whenever she comes over there, I mean, she wouldn't even leave daycare without me going and getting her. Like, she would throw a fit. I want my dad, you know. And so it was cool. We had a really cool relationship at the time, you know. And eventually, I needed to start going to school. So my dad said I could come and live with him and he'd help me get my driver's license back. And I started going to the DATC for welding. And my mom had offered me a job working for Newspaper Agency Corporation delivering newspapers. So I was working 7 days a week. I was going to school. And my daughter's mom had a relapse. And so my daughter was living with me at my dad's. And my grandpa had died. Which that was a whole nother thing in itself. My grandpa had tried to step in when my mom and dad had split up, and it's not that I was too far gone. I was just like, I was stuck in this criminal mentality that, I mean, it literally took me 10 years to retrain my way of thinking to being able to be accountable for who I am today and to understand like the way that society actually worked. 'Cause the way I saw it was wrong. I mean, it was completely backwards. I thought the cops were out to get me, that people were telling on me just to tell on me because that's what they wanted to do. And
that's the crazy thing. Like, as an addict, things is like, John thinks the cops are getting up this morning. They're trying to figure out how to bust me. You know what I mean? And cops are like, John, we don't even know who you really are. You know what I mean? The reason we do is because you keep putting yourself in front of us.
Oh, they knew who I was.
Stupid stuff.
They knew who I was by the end of it. And, yeah. And then that's the thing is, anyway, okay, let me continue with this. I mean, when my grandpa died, it was really depressing. It was a really big big break in mine. Me and Tara couldn't get along like our whole relationship, but we wanted to have a kid together for some reason. And we ended up having my daughter, Nicole, and I wouldn't trade my daughter for anything. I love my daughter with all my heart, and so does Tara. Tara loves her as well. She's a good kid. She's a really good kid. She doesn't really like school, but she's an artistic type, and she's... she's just an awesome kid. You know, she is. She really is an awesome kid. And, you know, she's got her own goals and things like that. My daughter was conceived about a year after was born about a year after my grandpa died, maybe a little more. Anyway, back to where I was at in my story. So my mom and her brothers finally settled the estate of my grandfather dying, and my mom got some money and she bought a house, or she put a down payment on a house, with two, so it had a mother-in-law apartment down in the basement, and me and my daughter were going to live down there, and my mom was going to live upstairs. I don't know how we were going to afford it. I mean, working for the newspaper this time, this is like the spiral of Media One. I mean, this is about when Media One took over Newspaper Agency
Corporation. Print media was going down.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so the newspaper was nothing, you know, and I'm starting to to feel that, and my addiction's coming back because Tara's having to come up. Eventually, it came to the point where Tara's got to come to my house to see my daughter because she was taking her to places that were unsafe. And then here comes my addiction creeping right back in, and it was like I'm getting bored. So I connected with somebody that I always connected with when I was lonely and bored, and I started smoking meth again. And I was doing it and trying to function, and then it spiraled out of control. Eventually, me and Tara got in a fight. She took off with my daughter to Alaska. And about this time, I met my ex-wife, and I started selling drugs and trying to think I was on top of the world, but I was still on parole. I stopped checking in. And
how did they feel about that when you stopped checking in on parole?
Well, so they didn't like that. They put my face. They didn't like that at all. No, they didn't like that. They didn't like that enough that they put my face in the newspaper as Utah's Most Wanted. And
the ones that you were delivering?
No, the standard examiner.
You're like, hey, look, it's me,
your paper boy.
That's exactly what it was. My cousin calls me. He's like, hey, you were seeing the newspaper today? And I was all, no, what do you mean? Well, just you can't come over. You can't come over no more.
Hey, Casey Scott here, and I'm happy to say our podcast, Project Recovery, is sponsored by Reprieve Recovery. Reprieve is a women's-only center located in Mountain Green, Utah. Find out more on their website at ReprieveRC.com.
So let me ask you this. What does your rock bottom look like before you turn your life around? Walk me through that.
Nothing. Like, I had nothing. I had ruined my CDL. My shame of my addiction had gotten so bad that I tried to commit suicide, and Jesus had to save my life. Like, literally, Jesus saved my life. Like, I tried to commit. I went to the middle of nowhere after trying to get sober again, going through the AACA and all that, and I was trying to do it on my own, and I had enough. Once I relapsed again, I went and bought enough heroin to kill me. I bought a gram of heroin. I put it in a spoon and I drew it up and I hit my vein. And next thing I know, I'm waking up in the ICU, and I was there. I think I was there for about 7 days, and I think I was in the BHU for about five. And then I went to Odyssey House for 3 months. And then I walked away from there after I got restarted on my birthday, and went homeless for a little while. Started with nothing. So by the grace of the community helping me, and pulling me back in, and Jesus just saying, no, you're not done yet. You're not done yet. That I walked into the rescue mission on a Saturday, and I said, and I talked to the house manager, Curtis, and I said, hey, Curtis, I think I want to join the new life program. And he said, okay, stay here a couple of days and we'll get you going on Monday. I said, I'm not going to stay on your floor. Because I had a backpack by this time with a tent and all that. I said, I'll come back Monday and I would like to join the new life program. So I went out, and at this point, this is when fentanyl was starting to become into everything. And, so I was real sick. It was in the meth really heavy at that time. And the meth that I was getting anyway. And I was sick. I was sick for 3 days or 2 days or whatever it was until Monday. And I remember I had like enough to buy a donut at just right behind here, actually. And so I went and got a donut, and I called my daughter's mom and I said, hey, I'm done. I don't know what to do. Will you let me come stay on your couch while I get sober and get a job and get my life together? And she said, hell no. No way am I going to let you stay here. And so I walked into the rescue mission that Monday and I said, okay, I'm here. I'm ready. And that's when my journey began. That's when I started getting to realizing what Jesus was doing for me and getting connected with Christ. I got rebaptized as a born-again Christian by the Potter's House Church in a river last September.
You know, I'm going to stop you because your eyes are swelling up a little bit and your demeanor changed once you started talking about this.
Well, it's amazing. I could tell you, like, my life today is amazing. Like, I know what accountability is today. I know what it means to be a person of respect. I know what it means to be accountable for my actions, what it means to walk into a situation it's not the best. Like, I've done a lot of homeless outreach. I've been homeless. You know, I did the whole time I was at the rescue mission. Like, I worked in the shelter there and I worked with the homeless. I got to see the worst cases. I got attacked on occasions and I didn't react in the way that I would at one point. You know, blood scraped all over. I know what it means to use the legal system for what the legal system is today. I don't think the cops are out to get me anymore. And you know what? The best thing about it is I completed probation. Because when I tried to commit suicide, I was in my car. And so I got a DUI for that. And I lost my CDL. I lost all of that. And I completed probation successfully. I actually, my probation officer wanted to come to my graduation of the New Life program because we had built that much of a rapport.
Did you notice that, Matt? Though, once he started talking about his recovery and his life now and what he's done.
His countenance brightened right up.
I mean, yeah. I mean,
like, life is different for me today. Like, so they put you on a week restriction when you first walk into the New Life program, and then they let you kind of have your reins. Well, the first place I went the day that I got off my restriction was to Fit to Recover. And because I was going to Fit to Recover a little bit before I tried to commit suicide when I was trying to get clean that time. And they were wonderful to me. Those people, I mean, Ian, I love Ian with all my heart and everybody there. I remember I walked in and the first person I saw was Tony. She was the creative arts director at that time. And I said, hey, can I come back? Will you guys help me? I'm in the New Life program and I've got, when I have free time, I would like to spend my free time at Fit to Recover. And she said, yeah, just come. And so when I was going there before, James wasn't working there yet. And he's the guy at the front desk, but it was Kate. And I remember I had called her on the phone and she said, just come in today. And she would reel me. Somehow she reeled me in every time that I had talked to her. She got me going to boot camp. She got me going to this class. And it was amazing. So I come back in and James is at the front desk. I'm all, where's Kate? And he's all, well, I do Kate's job now. I'm all, awesome. I'm all, I would like a scholarship. Would you guys put me on a scholarship? This is what's going on. I let him know about the New Life program and all that. And so I got really connected with these guys. And then Kate said, well, come to a couple classes and we'll give you another scholarship. So once I got two classes, they put me on a scholarship. And then they just kind of let me go the whole time I was in treatment for 11 and a half months and I had a scholarship the whole time. They still take care of me. I go in there three or four times a week, sometimes every day. And I'm just that between the New Life program and the FTR, that's what I really needed. And I've been to so many different treatment centers. It's just, I just needed somebody to believe in me. And I still have such great connections with Cassie Warner at the New Life program and Steve Spies. I mean, Steve was my counselor and Cassie's, I mean, there was days I would go into their office every day. I would be in tears, just not knowing how to react to certain situations because for so long it was violence and not telling on, not be co-signing for everything. And I didn't want it anymore. I was done. I was so done that it was just, I was miserable. I didn't want to live on the side of the road anymore, have to beg people for food. I didn't want that. I was miserable. I had to do something different. And that means I had to trust people. So I had to let go of it all. And I let go of it all. I let go of everything. I let Jesus redefine me 100%.
That's amazing.
They gave me keys. I'm going to show you this. USARA gave me keys to the building. I have keys and code. Keys and code to the building today. I have my own car. I paid for it. I have a dog. I have a little multi-poo. It's my best friend. Sleeps with me. I have my own place. It's in my name. Pay my bills. I'm self-reliant. And I get to go in and I get to go into all the hospitals and help people.
I was
going
to say, you have a lanyard on with two pretty impressive, not one, but two impressive institutions hanging around your neck that you're part of.
So, and that's not all of them.
What are they?
One for, tell everybody. USARA and one's the University of Utah.
Yeah.
And we also work with IHC and IMC. And I also work with Volunteers of America there with their Youth Resource Center.
So I am just so impressed because you said it so eloquently just right there. It's like I had to get rid of everything and I had to just trust people. And when you've been an addict and you've been on the street running and gunning, trust is not something that's given. It's not something it's hard to come by because you're just jaded with everything. And so you had to trust people. And here you are with keys to buildings. I've never seen somebody so excited about keys to building and having a code. But to you, that means everything.
Well, they trust me. Who trusts a convict, an ex-convict? I mean, I remember, like, I thought it was weird. Like, I felt like I would get going somewhere, and then they'd get my background back, and then they were trying to find a way to get rid of me.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It was like, and today, like, people want me to come work for them. They want me to apply for jobs because, like, the person that I've become. And it's like, why didn't I figure this out 30 years ago? Why couldn't I figure this out 20 years ago? I would have gone through so much less heartache.
I would just say, let that be the last time you ever think that. Doesn't matter. It's in the past. You are who you are today. Like, we have to go through certain things sometimes to get to the point where we can be the best self that we are. And so all those experiences, you had every disadvantage growing up, and you missed out on so many developmental milestones. So there were lessons that you learned, and I love his energy, don't you?
Yo, like, it's infectious.
You're so proud of yourself that I'm proud of you.
That is one of my... How long have we been doing this show?
5 years.
What you just did, John, with the keys is one of my favorite moments on this show in 5 years, because those keys symbolize the trust that these real, impressive institutions are giving you. Those two badges around your neck and all the groups you work with that value you. And that is a direct result of the fact that you are living a life of recovery. And I am so glad that I am here today. Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, and why we got you here, because you've seen 1,000 faces. You've rocked them all. I want to ask you a question, because I get it all the time. People wanting to reach out to me about finding recovery, finding help. And unfortunately, I always tell people, I was like, hey, I'm just a guy who does a podcast. I know some people and I can try to get you in connection with them. But one of the people, or one of the organizations I always try to steer people to, is USARA, because I think USARA is doing fabulous things. And my only regret is that there's not more USARA out there. So for those who don't know, real quick, what is USARA?
So what we are, it's... Utah Support Advocates for Recovery Awareness. And we're like the connection to everything. I have a resource packet that's, I think it's like 12 pages thick. And it just has different resources in the community. We're connected with almost every treatment center out there. They all know who we are, you know, and that's what we do. We do peer coaching. We're peer support. Everybody that works at USARA is either an addict or somehow tied to addiction, is a family member of an addict. We've all been there. Most of us have done jail time or been through different treatment centers and things like that. And you will walk into USARA and you will feel love. Like, there is, like, there, I don't think there is an employee there that doesn't tell. We tell each other we love each other all the time, and we show it. We show up for each other, and we're a part of each other. And it's the most amazing place. If you are struggling with addiction and you need help with connection, USARA. USARA is a wonderful place for you to start, and we'll help you connect any way that we can.
I love that. One more thing before we end this podcast, and I really don't want to end it because I just am having so much fun talking to you and hearing about your story. You said something when we first got here. You said one of your talents is meeting people where they are. What does that mean?
So today, I'll say I'm sitting at my desk, my phone rings, and it's the University of Utah. Hey, we have a person here that has been struggling with substance use disorder, and this is their substance. Will you come see it? And so we'll go up and we'll meet them at the emergency room, or we'll meet them wherever they're at, and we'll try and give them whatever support we can to help them to better their lives or better their journey.
See, that's so important, is meeting people where they are.
Yeah. Well, I mean, community and connection. I mean, you couldn't be a better example today of that theme that I feel like was running through the show today. That, like, think about the difference between how a person who struggled in the past with substance use disorder might have been thrown in with the car thieves and never get any help, versus now we got John and the USARA crew are coming and meeting you literally mentally, emotionally, and physically where you're at to provide you resources. I feel like we are lucky to have you, John, and USARA in Salt Lake City, because we never have to guess what are the resources ever again. We just have to call them up and they come and meet us. And as a clinician myself, it's invaluable. And I'm so glad that there are people listening so they know, yeah, I don't have to wonder what's available to my loved one who needs some help. I can just call USARA and they'll find it.
I love it. So, Dr. Matt, I know you just spoke, but what are your thoughts on John and his journey to recovery?
If John can do it, anybody can do it. And I think the difference is John just highlighted you have to get to a point where even if you've had all the disadvantages in life, when you're ready to let it all go and let a higher power take over and guide you in the right direction. And my favorite thing you said today, besides the keys, I think that's my favorite, is you mentioned you had to rely on the community. And it's like, there you go. We can't do big things alone. No, nobody can do big things alone. And thank you for highlighting the fact that community and connection is at the heart of recovery.
And I think the thing that's most impressive about you is Dr. Matt said it. You started this game with every disadvantage out there. And you spent majority of your life in survival mode. According to you, if you'd have done all your time at once, it'd have been 14 years. And you got to a point where you just wanted to stop. And what does it take to stop? Whatever it takes.
Surrender.
And surrender. And you did that beautifully. And you trusted people, even though you didn't want to, but you had to. And look where you are today. That's amazing. And you're now giving back. And that's what we do in the recovery world, is what we've been given, we give away freely. And that's what you got to do. And I think it's beautiful, man. And so thank you for stopping by and sharing your story. If people want more information about USARA or any of the programs you're associated with, what's the best way to get them?
Well, online. I mean, you can always look up USARA.com, myusara.com, or at fit2recover, fit2recover.com as well.
I think it's fit number two recovery.
Yeah.
And they do it. Like, I love Ian.
They're one of our favorites.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's also the rescue mission. And then it's the rescue mission of Salt Lake, not the Salt Lake City rescue mission. It's the rescue mission of Salt Lake. Mm-hmm. And they're on 463 South, 400 West. And these are all nonprofit organizations. So that means that the services that they provide are to help the community. And if for some reason, if they offer a service and it costs money, and you don't have the money, they will find a way to help you to get that service.
I love it.
And I know that every single one of them, I know that all the services that USARA offers is free. But some of the other stuff that does cost money, but I know that there's
scholarships are available.
Yeah, scholarships are available.
Yeah.
I love it. Well, thank you very much. You're a bright light in a dark world, and I love it. So thank you, John. Dr. Matt, thank you very much, and thank you to everybody out there who continually supports Project Recovery. We wouldn't be able to do this podcast if it wasn't for you guys. And in case you forgot, Project Recovery is what?
It is a KSL podcast, Casey Scott.
Let's see those keys one more time. Yeah.
Of this program are for informational purposes only. The program is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician, licensed therapist, or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard on this program. KSL does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the program. Reliance on any information provided on the program is solely at your own risk.
Hey, Casey Scott here from Project Recovery Podcast. When I took my first steps towards confronting my addiction, I needed a program that could help guide me through my recovery. That's why I wanted to tell you about Reprieve Recovery. They are a recovery center for women that recognize the importance of healing the spirit, mind, body, and are located in beautiful Mountain Green, Utah. You can learn more by calling 801-801-801. 252-6030 or visiting their website at reprieverc.com.